It's a trap!
Hello and welcome to episode number 10 of Radio TCX. I'm Tim Dugan.
And I'm Carson Ray.
And joining us today, we have a special guest sitting down from Fantasy Flight Games Organized Play Program. We have Mr. Wade Pichet joining us. Wade, thank you for being on the show.
Thank you, guys.
Wade was the marshal for the Adepticon event, so we have him here to share his insights.
So let's get started.
So Wade Pichet, member of Fantasy Flight Organized Play and longtime member of the Twin Cities X-Wing group. Wade, we're going to start off with a really tough first question. How would you describe your flying style as an elite pilot talent?
It's real tough, I know.
Oh, man. Like, not because I'm good, but because I've been around. I would probably have to go with veteran instincts.
Veteran instincts.
Right. You're a veteran?
Yeah, I mean, I've been playing X-Wing since it came out at Gen Con. So
how long were you involved before you joined Fantasy Flight Games? How long were you involved in kind of the local pseudo-competitive scene?
Since the beginning, really. I participated in the first FFG tournament, which was a week before the 2012 Worlds.
Okay.
I won that one.
Okay.
Which was pretty great.
How many people showed up to the first tournament?
Eight
players?
Eight players showed up for that. And it had me and James Elhart, who is used to be a local here and is down in Texas now. But we played at the top table. And then after that, you know, I ran FFG's Kessel Run tournament, which might be a little too old for you too.
Way before, my time, yeah. This would have been what, wave one, wave two?
Era? That was the wave two pre-release event that we did.
Because I know I started playing around wave four. So that was kind of right when that came out was when I started playing actively. What about you, Carson? When did you start playing?
I started after wave four, really just before wave five.
Yeah, and then from there, the regionals in 2013 I played in, topped eight. And then from there, I ended up getting a job with Fantasy Flight, being the head chef in the kitchen, which meant I had to put my competitive seasons to an end.
Working those late nights.
Puts a damper on those competitive play events.
Well, it's more of employees just not being allowed to play in competitive events.
Right, at a certain level.
So right, and that's part of any competitive game.
But from there, I ended up getting a job with the organized play team.
How long have you been with the organized play team?
It's been just over a year.
Okay.
Last Adepticon, which was mid-March, was like my first week. They just strapped me on a boat and shipped me there already.
And I will say Wade has been an important part of the Twin Cities X-Wing community. I remember the first tournament I played at, he was running that back in the day. He's also run some other great events. He run an annual tournament for charity called the Toys for Tots tournament, where everyone brings Lego sets or toys as the entry fee. And there's some cool prizes and raffles. And it's always a good time.
Yeah. This last year, we actually, Carson was our winner.
That's right.
We had like a lot of cool stuff, like a ticket to see Force Awakens with the entire FFG team.
It was a very fun prize to win.
Did you go to that?
Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome.
It was fun.
I didn't sit next to him.
Oh,
yeah. We sat close.
But apart from that, we also had, I'm a big Lego guy, so usually a large Lego set is involved at a lot of my charity events.
Yeah, I got second place 1 year, and I won the B-Wing. The top prize was the Slave One right when that came out, but I got a B-Wing, and that was pretty cool. Yeah. Gave that to my nephew.
Chris Jenkins won the Slave One. Last time I talked to him, he still hasn't built it.
That's terrible.
Well, I'm sure we could talk about the good old days to no end, but let's get into our discussion about the Hoth System Open at Adepticon. So the Hoth System Open took place from March 31st just through April 2nd. There were 2 days of preliminaries for the X-Wing event, one on Thursday and one on Friday, and then the top performing players from those 2 days were able to play on the final day, Saturday. They had to maintain a record of at least 18 tournament points out of the 6 Swiss rounds during the preliminaries. And then after that, they played 3 rounds of Swiss on Saturday morning, and then the top 8 did a final cut. So we're going to talk a little bit today about the different lists we saw and the faction representation. So let's start off with that.
So we had a pretty even split of the 3 different factions on our 2 preliminary days. There were 32% Rebels, 34% Imperials, and 33% Scum. Almost 34% Scum. About as even as you could get.
Which I think is healthy for the game, just to see that all the factions are represented and that everyone's trying different lists from different factions. There's no one clear winning list from any given faction.
That being said, overall, the Imperial players, a lot more of them made it to that final day on Saturday. The final day had 42% Imperial players, 28% Rebels, and 29% Scum.
Does that surprise you, Wade, just to see that kind of representation from Imperial lists?
Not really. Imperial Aces was a strong list going into Wave 8, throughout Star Championships, really.
Mm-hmm.
And seeing it just excel now with the Inquisitor is what I was kind of predicting.
And when you're looking at I mean, we had a really, really strong field of players to pull from. I think this was definitely a nationals caliber event in terms of player quality. We had people from all across the country coming into play. I think in general, those Imperial lists can be very hard to fly at a high level, so that when you have this many great players there, you're going to see some excellent Imperial aces.
And as you mentioned, that Inquisitor just opened up another price point in that Imperial ace options for which aces can you afford in your list.
Wait, what are your thoughts on the Inquisitor in competitive play now?
The Inquisitor gives the Imperial players just a slightly cheaper option compared to Vader and Soontir, mm-hmm. with still like a strong high pilot skill character.
So. Yeah, because what I would call kind of the standard Inquisitor we're seeing is the Inquisitor with Push the Limit, TIE V1 title, and auto thrusters. And that comes in at just 31 points, I believe, compared to like the standard Soontir Fel you'd see with Stealth Device and Auto Thrusters and Push the Limit coming in, I believe, at 35 points. So you are losing out on maybe 1 point of pilot skill there going from a 9 to an 8, but you do have 2 shields and 2 hull as opposed to just the 3 hull on an Interceptor, and that dial on the Inquisitor is pretty cool.
Right. Well, and the Inquisitor also has equal action economy with when you take the target lock action, getting the free evade, and then you can push the limit for another action, which compares to Soontir Fel's getting that free focus when you take your stress token from pushing the limit.
Maybe slightly less defensive because one of those actions is a target lock, as opposed to a standard Soontir taking an evade, pushing for a focus, and then getting a second focus for being stressed and using Soontir Fel's pilot ability. So maybe a little less defensive.
Right. It's definitely narrower, but it's also cheaper. Mm-hmm. And still comparable.
And the Inquisitor's pilot ability allowing you to take basically a range one shot regardless of what range you're attacking from, eliminating the auto thrusters bonus can be a big deal when auto thrusters has become such a prevalent card in standard X-Wing squads.
So driving some of these overall percent changes from the preliminary days to the final days, we have just a breakdown of these list archetypes from the different factions. So driving the high Imperial change from the preliminary days to the final day was mostly due to the Palpatine ace builds that had a showing of 14.3% in the preliminary days and 28% of the field in the final Saturday.
So that's to say that about just over 14% of the total squads from the 2 preliminary days consisted of Palpatine and then some kind of Imperial aces. And then going into the final day, that representation was a lot higher
doubled,
out of the overfield. Yeah.
So something we did notice is day one did have a lot higher representation with Imperial aces in the top 32 on day one.
Like how big of a representation of the top 32 would you say?
I'd have to spit like off the top of my head, I believe it was about 20.
So well over probably
that's
50%
like
of the field.
Of the people making the cut were Imperial aces.
That might just be due to players just bringing what they are familiar with compared to day two, where in which players might be trying to tailor their list to what did well day one.
Right, because me and Carson both played in the Friday qualifier, so we were there Thursday night kind of checking out the scene, seeing what was flying out there, and we did notice there were a lot of Imperial ace lists at the top tables. So I was kind of shocked going into the second day of preliminaries, seeing the number of U-boats and Jumpmaster lists that we saw.
Right. Well, there was also, the triple Jumpmaster list had a pretty strong showing of like 13.5% of the field in the first 2 days. And part of the Imperial player success is I think they are a strong matchup against those triple Jumpmaster lists.
Yeah, because those triple Jumpmasters are still dependent on their arcs. So if you have ships that can effectively arc dodge or even effectively get to range one, because you really lose out on the triple, what we call missile boats or U-boats, where they're loaded up with plasma or proton torpedoes. Those really are at their best when they're shooting at range 3 and they get that first volley in, because then there's a fair chance they're going to also get a second volley of those heavily modified torpedoes coming at you. So if you can boost in real hard and get to range 1, you have a pretty good chance of denying them those missile shots.
The ability to mitigate range or just dodge arc entirely that those Imperial Ace lists bring to the table is a huge advantage right now. Looking at the Scum side of the event, while Scum overall took a hit going on to the final day, both the triple Jumpmaster lists and dual aggressor archetypes both had an increased percentage showing on the final day.
And those are the archetypes you're probably expecting to see in Scum lists. Scum has been a developing faction ever since it came out. We're getting new ships all the time. But really the two archetypes people have fallen into now is the dual aggressor list, and now the triple Jumpmaster list has become a really popular archetype.
It is exciting to see those established archetypes of the new faction making a strong showing. Mm-hmm.
So we did see a pretty fair representation of triple Jumpmaster lists, what we'll probably just keep calling U-boats for the rest of the day. The general stock U-boats, for people who don't know, is a contracted scout Jumpmaster with Deadeye, plasma torpedoes, extra munitions, guidance chips, and R4 agromech. We've been seeing some variance in that, but that's kind of the standard build at 33 points a
ship.
That's
the power package.
Yeah, I would call those stock boats. But a lot of people were worried that these ships are way too efficient for the game of X-Wing. They put out damage at a really high rate. We've talked about it before, but with plasma torpedoes, the likelihood of getting four hits is...
Oh, it's like 73%. If you bump that up to proton torpedoes, then you're looking in the 90% range.
Yeah. So people have found different... We saw a lot of variations of this list, but a lot of people were worried about this, thinking it's going to kind of overtake the game. So Wade, I wanted to ask you, do you think this list is overpowered? Do you think people are overreacting to its efficiency?
I really think the meta for Wave 8 is just too new still at this point.
Mm-hmm. We've only really had one major event
really, in 2 weeks. Like, it came out about 2 weeks prior. I remember when people were all up in arms about four TLTs in the list. And
the quad TLT
and
list.
And thinking it was the end times for X-Wing, just because it was just such a strong list. But
and it was easy to fly, quote unquote.
Yeah. Players, adapt with new meta. I do think players will find this U-boat list to just be another list.
So you're saying, because they were fairly successful, the winning list at the Hoth Open was a triple Jumpmaster list, but is your point to say that people just haven't figured out effective strategies to counter this yet? They're just too new, so people are not used to how to fly against them.
Yeah, I mean, people beat them all weekend.
That's true.
Like, there's one list that won, and it was because, I think it was more because it was unique compared to the other ones.
And I think really well flown.
Yes, yeah, I definitely agree there.
And I think it is, a lot of people tend to identify lists like the quad TLT Y-Wings or now the triple Jumpmaster lists as easy to fly or beginner level, or that they're not really though. You have a really powerful Alpha Strike, but it does take a lot of player skill to fly those lists to their potential, because Jumpmasters is really about late game blocking if you're going to win with those lists.
Right.
A lot of people can get the torpedoes, that Alpha Strike with the torpedoes to work, but it's all about how you handle those ships after you've run out of torpedoes that lets you win games.
Right. Well, when you complain about a list that has high damage efficiency, probably your issue is that you're flying right at it and playing the game that they want to be playing.
Exactly.
You're probably not going to beat Jumpmasters by flying right at them and letting them get their torpedoes off.
Right now, I think they're probably the most efficient jousting ships in the game, so it's usually unwise to joust them.
Especially not in those opening turns.
So the faction that had the lowest day two representation was definitely the Rebel faction, right?
Right, your faction.
My faction. I, of course, was flying my classic Poe Dameron with the Stress Hog and the three bandits, but we did see some new Wave 8 representation coming from the Ghost, right?
Yeah, the Ghost had an overall 11% showing on Thursday and Friday, and then went down to just 8.5% on Saturday.
That's not a huge loss, though, in terms of percentage and representations. That's pretty cool.
I mean, some people are figuring it out. It's a new ship. A lot of moving pieces, hard to pick an efficient build.
Yeah, and I think people are a little afraid of the triple Jumpmasters too. That definitely weighed into the decision, don't you think, Wade?
The main decision, I think, is Rebels didn't really have a go-to for shipbuilding.
Right, there's not an automatic list that you modify or tweak.
Yeah, where Imperial Aces is like, all right, I run Imperial Aces, now I'm going to try it with an Inquisitor, and maybe that's it.
You know, I either have a Vader or a Whisper, and I either have a Palp Shuttle or an Omega or something, yeah.
Yeah, and then the U-Boat was something, you know, that players kind of figured out and together just decided to run a bunch of.
So right. Like,
and Rebels, I think, currently aren't seeing play just because players haven't taken the time to look into their meta yet.
Which I think is a shame, because I really think the Ghost will be a viable competitive ship, because you can get a very efficient Ghost for without having to dedicate a lot of points to it. Because even with just those four dice and a fire control system and a couple 1 or 2 point crew members, you can have a Ghost that's pretty effective.
And then like you look at just overall what the game has done with Rebels. The Rebels have won 3 world championship titles.
Right.
So like if anything, maybe it's just time for them to sit down for a little bit.
Take the backseat so we can get some of these scum ships in there. Wouldn't it be great if Scum won a world championship?
They haven't gotten one yet.
Oh, man. Well, they've only had one to play in, right?
That's right.
So let's talk specifically about the top performing lists after the cut, basically on the final day. The top 8 lists, top 4 lists. To break those down, really good representation from the Imperial faction.
Once again,
right?
Story of the weekend. Imperial players had a very strong showing.
So I believe it was 5 out of the top 8 lists were some variant of Imperial Aces or Palpatine Aces.
There were 4 Palpatine Ace builds and 1 triple ace build.
And then pairing that up with 2 scum lists, both of which were triple U-boats, but very different, so we can talk about that. And then 1 rebel representation in a Ghost Poe Talisquadron list. So let's start by breaking down these Imperial faction lists.
So let's start off with Lyle Hayhurst, who was our top seed going into the top 8 cut.
He was undefeated in Swiss.
Right, actually the only player who finished undefeated.
Nine rounds, that's actually pretty impressive, given that on that final day, those last three matches are going to be against some of your toughest opponents.
And Lyle was the only player who took the Omicron group pilot for his Palpatine shuttle.
As opposed to Yor, which we've been seeing a lot of recently.
And part of that's because he fit a lot more into his ace slot. He has Karner Jax with Push the Limit, Auto Thrusters, Omega Leader with Juke and Comm Relay.
The kind of standard build we've been seeing for Omega Leader.
And then Wampa. So this is an Imperial Ace build that, with Karner Jax and Omega Leader, are both aces that are pretty strong against like the Jump Masters and other aces. And then he also has Wampa, who is an excellent ace hunter.
Especially a Whisper counter, because Wampa's ability to cancel a crit and then deal a face-down damage directly to hull is great and works really well with the Palpatine ability to generate a crit by using Palpatine.
Right. Whisper, the Inquisitor, Corrin Horn, any ship with two hull, Wampa puts a really quick time clock on.
Well, really, any ship with the capability of regenerating too. That's one thing I usually do with Wampa is...
Right, yeah, that does also get under Poe.
Even, yeah, Poe or the Corrin Horn E-Wing. Because that can be terrible, because you can put down a fair bit of damage, and if a Corrin Horn or a Poe Dameron just keeps regenerating those shields, this way, if you're dealing damage directly to hull, it's there, it's not going anywhere. So even if you lose your Wampa, you've already done that damage, and it's not as hard to kill those ships. So the only Imperial list from the top eight not to run a Palpatine shuttle was Nathan Ide's list. Nathan was second place at Worlds this past season, and he is an excellent player, by all counts.
And Nathan flew Darth Vader with adaptability, the TIE X1 title, the advanced targeting computer, an engine upgrade, coming at 34 points. And then he flew the Inquisitor with Push the Limit, Auto Thrusters, the TIE V1 title, and Soontir Fel with just Push the Limit and Auto Thrusters. So that's just a 32-point Soontir Fel.
Wade, what are your thoughts on having Vader with the adaptability, the new adaptability EPT versus Vader with Veteran Instincts?
Nathan was really going for a low initiative bid, which, I mean, would put him on the top against the other Imperial Aces lists. Mm-hmm. So
having that extra point.
Yeah, he arc dodged his way to the top eight, and it worked for him. So I'm actually really impressed with his list.
You don't need stealth device if you're able to get out of arc every time, but that's a pretty risky move. You got to be pretty confident in your ability. Big props to Nathan for taking that bold move.
The remaining three Imperial lists all featured a Palpatine shuttle using the Yor pilot as opposed to the Omicron group pilot.
Zach Bunn's Captain Yor build had Emperor Palpatine and Ion Projector, and then he flew that with Darth Vader with Veteran Instincts, the TIE X1 title, Advanced Targeting Computer, and Engine Upgrade, and the Inquisitor with Push the Limit, Auto Thrusters, and the TIE V1 title.
Kind of the standard Inquisitor we've been seeing time and time again at 31 points. I think it is interesting he threw an Ion Projector on his Yor. A lot of people are already kind of hesitant to upgrade Omicron Group Pilot to Captain Yor because that is a 3-point price hike in squad points. So throwing that extra 2 points on for Ion Projector, I'm wondering what his thought process was there.
Well, part of this is we see these skilled players being more effective with their shuttles. They're not just sitting there triggering Palpatine's ability. They're getting it up and into the fight, throwing out that it does have a high damage output with 3 primary attack dice.
Yeah.
And is a pretty effective blocker when used well. And if you put Ion Projector, that gives you much more powerful blocking ability.
Yeah, when I'm playing against a list like this, if I see them set their shuttle up in the corner as far away from me as possible, that's good for me because that means I don't have to deal with those extra 3 attack dice and that potential block. I think it is really the top tier players who really incorporate that shuttle into their combat and make sure it stays close.
And you do want to sit with your shuttle for maybe the first turn or two to see where your opponent's going, because it is hard to change plans really hard with the shuttle. You want to watch, see where they're going, and then spring into action.
And if you want to use Captain Yor's ability, of course, he does have to be pretty close to the fight to pull those stress tokens off of your other ships, which can make all the difference, especially if you're able to do something like K-turn a Whisper and still take an action. That can be clutch in a game of X-Wing, especially at the top tier.
So the final two Imperialists, Brad Miller and D. Yoon, both flew the same list, Captain Yor with Palpatine, Whisper with Veteran Instincts, Agent Kallus, Fire Control System, and Advanced Cloaking Device, and Omega Leader with Juke and Comm Relay.
And they played each other in the first round, which is interesting.
So it's hard to see the overall success of the list when they do get a mirror match in the opening round.
Right from
the
get-go. Brad and D, both from the Minox Squadron podcast. Kind of unfortunate that they did get that first round mirror match pairing in the top eight.
Those are both fun guys. Check out their show.
It was a close game, though. The parts of it that I saw, there were some real close calls there, but Brad was able to take it in the end.
Then on to the lone Rebel player in the top eight, Jason McMahon from the Twin Cities.
Representing.
Not only was he flying Rebels, he was flying a Ghost. We had Chopper with Hera Syndulla, Ezra Bridger, Ion Projector, Fire Control System, and a Dorsal Turret, coming in at 48 points. And then he had Poe Dameron with Auto Thrusters, Predator and R5P9, and then a Talus Squadron Z95, finishing off at 100 points total.
So let's talk for a minute about the synergy of the two crew members he chose for his Ghost. Of course, he chose Fire Control System as his system slot. It's hard to beat that when you've got a ship with four attack dice, being able to get that free action.
Right.
But combining really well with the Ezra Bridger crew card, which when you're stressed, you're able to convert one of your focus results into a critical hit result. And combining that with the Harrison Dula crew card, who allows you to assign and take red maneuvers even when you're stressed.
The Ezra Bridger ability is pretty comparable to the Rear Admiral Chernu ability, modifying one focus result into a crit. And you combine that with having a target lock, that's a lot of modification on your four dice attack or five die at range one. And you get to trigger that with Hera's ability where you don't care if you're stressed, you can still do any maneuver on your dial. And you don't need the actions because you're already modifying your dice so much.
Several of the games I saw Jason play, he just had a pile of stress next to that ship. So he did not care. He was just 5K turning all the time, which is an amazing maneuver on that big base.
I think
ship.
It had more stress than a lot of stress hogs did.
But a great combo, and it was cool to see that represented in the top eight. So the final two lists that made the top eight were two triple U-boat lists, but kind of different U-boat lists, kind of showing us different representations of how you can assemble these squads. So Darwin Schaefer flew what I'd call the stock U-boats, which is the one I mentioned before, Deadeye, Plasma Torpedoes, R4 Agromech, Extra Munitions, and Guidance Chips. Three of those, 33 points each on the contracted scouts. That's kind of the standard triple U-boat list versus a very different triple U-boat list coming from the winner of the Hoth System Open, Ryan Fleming. He flew with triple U-boats, but Carson, can you tell us what's on those boats?
Yeah, so they were all still the Pilot Skill 3 contracted scout. One of them had Guidance Chips, Deadeye, the Overclocked R4, and Plasma Torpedoes. So the Overclocked R4 is only 1 point compared to the R4 Agromech, which opens up more options and is comparable damage output for getting your torpedoes off.
Because when you spend a focus, you're able to receive a stress token to get another focus.
So you still have modification on your torpedo that you fired using your focus for Deadeye. You don't have a target lock, you have a focus instead, but that's comparable.
It just costs you a stress.
So you're then going to be in a tougher point to consistently keep getting that damage output every turn, but you have the option to also use a focus on defense and still be able to get a torpedo off. And this frees up a point for other stuff. He had another contracted scout with Guidance Chips, Deadeye, Overclocked Astromech, Plasma Torpedoes, and Extra Munitions.
The first one did not have extra munitions, the second
right.
one does.
So we have a 30-point one, a 32-point one, and then one with Guidance Chips, Deadeye, R4 Agromech now, Proton Torpedoes, Extra Munitions, and the Boba Fett crew card.
And I did see this build a couple times. It does come in at 97 points.
Right, so a lot of that point trimming is to get a stronger initiative bid, mostly for your mirror match, because you want to be shooting first so that you can trigger Boba Fett with your Proton Torpedo.
Well, and not even just shooting first, you also want to be moving first, because you want to be action-denying those other ships with some well-placed blocks.
Absolutely, you do not want to be the boat that got blocked. You want to be the ones that all have focus tokens.
So, Wade, what is your thought on this matchup? Do you think this is the ideal way to run the triple U-boats?
There is one thing I think is very unique about this list, and where the normal contracted scout all being equipped the same, players don't have to focus too much on what ship is which. Mm-hmm. Where this one, each ship is equipped differently, and there's just that much more that the opponent has to worry. Like, you know, like try to track and remember like what is what.
Right, which one fired its torpedo, which one had the extra munitions and still has a torpedo to fire.
Or where's Boba Fett, you know, like, and that, sure, you could always ask your opponent what is where, but that is still, like, it's on a different level where your opponents are just trying to track everything that is going on in that game.
Yeah, there is an advantage to adding that little bit of extra mental strain on your opponent by having three similar-looking ships, but all equipped differently.
And after 12 games, it's, you know, for any player, it could be hard.
Not to mention all these ships shooting at three, you can fire them in any order. So the two that have plasma torpedoes are able to hopefully strip shields off of a good ship. And then you can use your proton torpedoes on the Boba Fett ship, which have a very high efficiency, much higher than plasma torpedoes with guidance chips. There's a likelihood of 90%+ that they're going to put four hits through. One of those is probably going to be a crit using the proton torpedo ability to change a focus result to a crit. And if you can get that crit through, you're then able to trigger Boba, discard Boba to discard an upgrade card on that ship you're shooting.
Right, and that can do amazing things like get rid of a Palpatine or even get rid of a Deadeye or R4 aggro mech in the mirror match.
And that'll make all the difference, because if you get rid of an aggro mech in a mirror match, their efficiency goes down drastically.
Ryan, in his final match, was able to shoot Brad Miller's Palpatine out the airlock on his shuttle.
Actually, I watched a lot of Ryan's games, and Boba Fett did a lot of the work for him, I believe.
Additionally, with this asymmetrical triple Jumpmaster build, it makes a tough game for your opponent. I don't want to be the one shooting the 30-point boat. I want to shoot the 35-point boat, and Ryan can really use that to his advantage. Knowing the target priority your opponent has, you can make your opponent make a lot of tough decisions.
Absolutely, because the one that doesn't have extra munitions, once it fires its torpedo, you really don't want to focus fire on that. You want to get a torpedo off the board before it's able to shoot. So a big congratulations to Ryan Fleming for winning the Hoth System Open, and we're excited to see how he does at the Coruscant Invitational at Star Wars Celebration.
This is a really innovative list, and he flew it very well.
So Wade, let's talk for a minute about the structure of this tournament. This was a little different than other premier FFG events we've been seeing recently. So let's start off with talking about the point structure for the cut.
Well, the point structure we based off of was to ensure that all the X and 2s made it into the top day, because at that point, it's really hard for anyone else to make the top 8 cut.
But there was a potential that you could have a 4-2 record, 2 full wins and 2 modified wins, and then you'd only have 16 tournament points, which would not make the day 2 cut. Why did you pick 18?
The reason for 18 was more so we can make sure that we got all the 6-0s into the final day, because you could go 6 games each with a modified win, and that would just barely hit you at 18.
Oh, because that would be a bummer to go undefeated and not make the cut.
Yeah, that would be bad.
Well, I really liked the format, Carson. Did you?
Yeah, it was fun that like you just had to play to win and not necessarily play the MOV game.
And we've kind of been realizing that 6 rounds is probably like the optimal amount of rounds that players kind of enjoy playing in a day.
Before the strain of the event and the 9, 10, 11 hours of X-Wing starts to wear on you?
I myself cannot stand going until like 2 in the morning anymore, so.
Right, when it gets late, I'm like, all right, let's just joust and roll dice and see what, let's get this over with.
Well, especially at a premier event where tensions are already kind of high, people are trying to play at a really high level, but that's hard to do when you're exhausted. We didn't have a meal break even that day, so it can be tough.
So the Hoth Open had an awesome selection of prizes. Wade, what came into coming up with the idea for these prizes? Let's talk about the full art cards. Those have been something you guys haven't done before.
Well, we haven't even really done generics in a long time. And I think the main idea behind the full art cards was to do a new and exciting way to release generics.
Right, because you don't really need the text in the middle for those guys.
Nope, and like the movie stills are great, but there's only so many movie stills of ships.
And why did you guys option? Because the full art cards and the laminated full art cards were prizes for the Hangar Bay event. So why did you guys option to make those also available to everyone who qualified for the final day of the main event?
The final day participants might have not had a chance to participate in a Hangar Bay.
If they played in the Friday qualifier, say, and then played through to the very end and did not get to enter the Hangar Bay event.
Yeah, okay. So we wanted to make sure that everyone had an equal opportunity. And those, honestly, I think what we've learned in OP is people really like the cards the most. So, you know, making sure players get a card is something that's important to us as well.
Well, those are really cool. The alt art cards are really cool. So I'm glad those are pretty prevalent at the tournament. I was able to get 2 sets, from one from the Hangar Bay and then one from Making Day 2, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, those full arts were awesome, especially the shiny plastic ones. I really hope we get to see more of those in the future.
Well, I will keep that in mind.
And some other great prizes. Everyone who made the final day got a set of really cool acrylic shield tokens. The top 32 got a set of range 1 and range 2 rulers, Carson included
in that.
Those
are a very handy tool in the game.
And they match the shield tokens, right?
They do.
And the top 8 got a full set of matching maneuver templates, which is pretty great.
Yeah, this was the first time we did the range 1 and range 1, 2 officially. And it sounds like, I mean, obviously it did pretty well. I wouldn't be surprised if it was something we did again, because it is something even handy for marshals and judges as well to use for those close calls.
Yeah, it is good to see them in an official capacity now, too, because those are some of the most useful measuring tools in the game. Because sometimes it's really hard with a full measuring range ruler to figure out if something really is in at range 1. So it's nice to be able to lay down that dedicated range 1 template to see if it fits between the bases. So, Wade, you have a lot of say in what prizes go into these kits and what is used. So what is kind of your thought process in when you're helping to pick these out? What pilot cards to do? What kind of acrylics to do? Do you have any insight into that process?
Well, there's a lot of variables that go into choosing what is in a kit. Trying to make kits appealing and exciting for players is something we try to do. I follow the forums a lot to see what players like. Not saying that that will make it, but
right.
Hearing suggestions is always helpful.
You got an ear out in the community to see what people like.
Oh, yeah. I always made it my goal to make sure that I am on the forums and stuff to see what people are saying about the OP program and stuff like that. So I'm just curious, guys. Do you have any cool suggestions for OP items?
Ooh, that's a good question.
Well, I got to start off IG-88B. I definitely need one of those to go with my IG-88C now.
You want to have a matching set. It would be cool if it was like one scene, if they could somehow do that. Or they were both. That wouldn't make any sense, though.
I need a challenge coin that's scum challenge coin. I love the Rebel Imperial challenge coins, but as a scum player now, I need a scum challenge coin. I think maybe the credit sign on one side and, I don't know, like cross guns or
just
the skull.
Like the Bantha skull. Absolutely. Or whatever. That'd be great. Carson, the one we have been talking about that we'd love to see is a, because you guys do double-sided cards now. We've seen that with adaptability, where one side isn't just the regular backing, right?
Well, OP doesn't, but yes.
OP, yeah, obviously. But we were looking for, so we want a crack shot card where side A is a shot from Han Solo in the cantina, like reaching for his blaster pistol. And then when you flip it over, when you've spent it, it's a dead Greedo on the table.
That has nothing to do with X-Wing.
But it's amazing.
That's the crack shot moment.
I would collect those to no end. It'd be fantastic.
Put it on all your TIE fighters.
Everything, man. It'd be fantastic.
Well, I'll keep it in mind.
So there's been kind of some substantial changes to the tournament schedule for the coming year. Did you want to comment on that, Wade?
Yeah, so we are splitting our Star Wars games from the rest of our competitive organized play games to be on their own timeline.
Okay, so they'll have their own tournament calendar and schedule for the year.
Yep, essentially we split them in half and put them on opposite calendars. So this year after Worlds in November 2016, we will start immediately with our regionals for the Star Wars games.
Okay, so there won't be a store championship season between basically this regional season and next?
Correct. Yeah, in order to make it work, we didn't have the time to do a store championships, and those regionals in November will lead into the Worlds in May.
But there still will be a store championship season in 2017.
Yep, and that starts immediately after the May Star Wars World Championship.
Well, a lot of exciting things are happening in organized play, so I think we look forward to all these changes and all the new prizes that we're going to see in upcoming tournament kits and premier events.
Yeah, we definitely have some cool surprises for you guys later on, too.
I can't wait to see them.
Excellent. I'm excited.
Wade, thank you so much for joining us on the show today. It's been a pleasure. We hope we can have you on again soon sometime.
Perhaps. Yeah, we'll see what happens.
Yeah, thanks for joining us, Wade.
Thanks a lot, guys, for having me.
Big shout out to Mac Baxter, who ran our Minnesota Campaign Against Cancer event. We had 82 players and raised over $3,000.
That's an awesome turnout for a great cause. Thank you guys for listening. If you want to stay up to date on news from the podcast, please go on to facebook.com/radiotcx and like our Facebook page. That's where we post updates.
And always, you can follow us on Twitter @radiotcxpodcast.
Again, guys, thank you for listening. Goodbye.
See you later.
We'll